Live from KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. The Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica report that at least 14 villages in Alaska have employed police officers whose criminal records should have prevented them from being hired under state law. The news organizations reported Saturday that they found more than 34 officers who should have been ineligible for these jobs. They say that on all but three cases, the police hires were never reported by city governments to the state's Department of Public Safety as required. The news organizations report that in eight additional communities, local tribal governments have hired tribal police officers convicted of domestic violence or sex abuse. The news organizations say that all 42 of these tribal and city police officers have rap sheets that would prevent them from being hired by the Anchorage Police Department and its urban peers as Alaska State Troopers or even as private security guards, most anywhere else in the United States. Many remain on the job. The Alaska House failed to fund the capital budget for the second day in a row today. It fell short by only one vote, and House leaders plan another vote on the measure later this month. All 23 House majority members and five minority caucus Republicans voted to fund the capital budget by drawing from a state savings account, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, or CBR. Sarah Rasmussen voted for it. She's an Anchorage Republican in the minority caucus.
Funding this budget through the CBR is not the path I would have personally chosen. Again, with little compromise reached in the last month, I feel that the best path forward for all Alaskans, and specifically my neighbors in Sand Lake who have reached out to me, is to support funding the capital budget, including almost $1 billion of federal match.
But seven minority caucus Republicans voted against it, and four were absent. That left the bill one vote short of 30, or three-quarters of the chamber. That's the level the state constitution requires to draw from the CBR. Opponents of the draw say they're concerned about a provision that would allow the reserve to fund future spending bills this session. Wasilla Republican David Eastman says this takes power away from the minority since future bills won't require 30 votes.
I understand that if it's a majority vote only, my vote will not be considered and my district will not be represented, so I'll be a no vote today.
House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent, says the House will vote on the bill again this month. The House Finance Committee raised its proposal for the permanent fund dividend to $1,600. A new version of a bill setting the dividend amount would also restore funding for most items vetoed by Governor Mike Dunleavy. It would accept $89 million in vetoes, including $20 million in cuts to the University of Alaska and a cut to school bond debt reimbursement and rural school construction. Nome Democratic Representative Neil Foster says the bill strikes a balance.
This is just trying to balance all the different interests of folks who wanted more cuts, folks who wanted a higher PFD, folks who didn't want to go into savings.
He noted that the measure relies on using all $172 million in the statutory budget reserve, a piggy bank the state has largely drained in recent years. Wasilla Republican Representative Colleen Sullivan Leonard says the state should use more permanent fund earnings to pay out the full amount of permanent fund dividends under the formula set in 1982. That would be roughly $3,000.
I just need to make this statement and ask how we've come to this decision of just not coming to the earnings reserve account to pay for a full statutory PFD. The funds are there. The funds are there to pay for general government. They're there to pay for the disbursement of the statutory permanent fund.
Paying the full PFD would require the state to violate a different law that limits the amount drawn from permanent fund earnings. Members of both legislative majority caucuses have expressed concern that violating that law would set a bad precedent. They say would threaten the long-term sustainability of dividends, state services, and the Alaska economy. If the legislature passes the bill without the full PFD, Governor Mike Dunleavy could veto it. He supports full dividends. University of Alaska Board of Regents has adopted a declaration of financial exigency, enabling immediate budget cutbacks, including expedited faculty layoffs. Regents approved the declaration in Anchorage today in response to an over 40% reduction in state funding. The federal government has dropped its appeal in the King Cove Road case. At least for now, that leaves in place U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason's decision blocking a land exchange for a road corridor through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Gleason ruled in March that former Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke didn't adequately explain his decision when he reversed course and approved the land exchange after his predecessor denied it. Trustees for Alaska attorney Bridget Passerianos represents environmental groups who say a road would damage the refuge and the wildlife species that rely on it.
When Secretary Zinke signed that land exchange agreement, he didn't really address those prior findings and didn't have any real findings of fact or any record to rely on, and that's just not how administrative agencies are permitted to make decisions.
The federal government appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but Passerianos says even then, Interior Department officials suggested they might seek a different legal approach to building the road. Passerianos doesn't think the issue is over. The Sitka Sentinel has been a cornerstone of Southeast Alaska print journalism for the past 75 years, with the Paulson family at the helm for the last 50 years. And now, one of the youngest members of the family is finding her feet in the business, one local story at a time. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
They got the paper out kind of early today.
19-year-old Ariadne Will stands next to the Sitka Sentinel's heavy-duty printing press. It's around 3 p.m., and the paper is about to be hot off it, handed off to carriers in stacks, and circulated throughout the city. Will weaves past the machinery as it starts to fire up. She knows the floor plan pretty well, and she warns me to watch my clothes.
You can't lean against anything in here. Like, I remember I got this, like, yellow dress for my birthday when I was, like, 6, and I wanted to wear it here, and I remember being, like, really careful not to get any ink on it.
She did get ink on it, and it stuck, along with an interest in a profession that spanned generations of her family. Her grandparents, Thad and Sandy Paulson, bought the Sitka Sentinel in 1969. So she grew up in Sitka, surrounded by reporters and paper and the big pieces of machinery that synthesized it all.
This big orange thing used to be where they paste up before they had InDesign. So you'd have like all these little pieces of wax paper on the ground. And it was always my job as a little kid to pick up all the pieces of paper.
And now Will is interning at the Sentinel, the summer between her freshman and sophomore year at Middlebury College in Vermont. A lot of the big machines are still there, unused. The printing process is slightly less analog now, even while the work is much the same.
I'd like to be a journalist someday. I guess I'm doing that right now, but yeah, like in the long run, I really like writing. I really like interviewing people. Like, I love when you can talk to someone and they get really excited about what they're talking about and they like tell you all these things that you never knew.
And it isn't just her grandparents. Her father was a reporter and her mother is an English teacher, so writing just runs in the family. But journalism?
Reporting never really even stuck out to me until I was like 16. Like, it took a really long time.
What changed? The 2016 election cycle and increasing use of the term fake news as a tool to discredit reporting.
Being raised at a newspaper, like, I know how important journalism is, even if that wasn't something that was at the forefront of my mind. And watching a bunch of newspapers be kind of attacked and called fake, that kind of stung a little bit. And so it started off as just, like, me wanting to know the truth and wanting to be able to communicate the truth to other people.
And she's doing that this summer, learning from Sentinel reporter Shannon Hoagland how to hold politicians accountable at the local level.
Like, if you don't have someone telling you what the assembly is doing, then people don't notice and people don't care. And even if people aren't noticing anyway, the assembly notices.
But local journalism isn't just covering assembly meetings. A local reporter doesn't really get a beat. They cover everything. A couple of weeks ago, Will was sitting in a friend's backyard watching a new local beekeeper buzz around. Hives are few and far between in Sitka. She mentioned it to Hoagland later.
Shannon was like, you should write a story about the bees. And I was like, that's a really good idea. Like, why hadn't I thought of that before? And just thinking of things not just as like, oh, like funky things that are happening, but as like this would make a good story is definitely a different frame of mind.
But as the news landscape is radically changing, how does a young reporter consume the news? Will gravitates toward the gray lady, but she likes to listen to all the news that's fit to print.
I kind of have a crush on the New York Times. I love them. There's one of the reporters that they have on like the New York Times podcast, The Daily, a lot. I like follow him on Instagram, and it's like his personal Instagram. Like, doesn't make a lot of sense because I'm not like learning anything, but it's just like when I hear his voice, it's like, oh, it's Michael Schmidt, like my favorite.
But even as the oldest papers evolve, good reporting at its root won't change. Something she's learned growing up at the heart of the Sentinel. It's all about paying careful attention to the facts and details and getting a good edit.
I remember walking down the halls of Keat with my grandmother, actually, and we walked past this one sign that said something about the fire marshal. And we're just walking down the hall, and she stops and says, Marshall only has one L.
And so does journalist. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
And finally, today in Juneau, an Alabama woman became the first person with Down syndrome to sing the national anthem in all 50 states.
And the home of the brave.
Ashley Doremus is an advocate for people with Down syndrome. She started Quest in California in 2013. She and her family chose Juneau for their final stop. She sang before a small crowd in front of the USS Juneau Memorial on the Seawalk. Mayor Beth Weldon congratulated Doremus for accomplishing her goal and gave her a key to the city.
We're just very honored that Ashley chose Juneau and Alaska to be the last state and the last city to which she sang the national anthem. We're thrilled to have her here today.
Doremus said she was inspired to sing her way across the country by her best friend, Claudette.
She's the one who told me, don't let anyone tell you what you can't do. Show them what you can do.
Doremus is also a fashion designer and public speaker. She said her next goal is to try skydiving. And the weather tonight, mostly cloudy, isolated rain showers, lows in the mid-50s. That's it for the KTO News Update for Monday, July 22nd, 2019. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.